Hello and welcome to Boomeranging, from expat to repat, a podcast that explores the question, what could be so hard about returning home after years living overseas? I'm your host, Margot Anderson, and in each episode, I will sit down with a former Aussie expat to discuss how they survived repatriation and reverse culture shock, how they navigated the logistics of careers, friends, and family to successfully find their new place at home, and all without losing their global spirit. If you have just returned home, are thinking about it, or just love a good yarn told by professional globetrotters, then I have no doubt you'll enjoy meeting this diverse group of Australians. Leonora was extremely excited when she landed in Hong Kong, a place that offered not just career opportunities but also family connections. It gave her reason to think that this could potentially be her forever home. But in 2021, COVID made Leonora feel uncomfortably isolated from family and confirmed for her that Australia was where she wanted to base herself. But she didn't just flick the switch and jump on the next flight home. That would be too risky for this risk professional. She took the same structured approach that she used to manage a career in risk and financial services to managing her move home, both personally and professionally. In short, Leonora treated finding a job like a job, and 6 months later she found herself juggling opportunities for employment, business, and a board role with a not-for-profit. For those expat repats who find comfort in structure, she is a great example of how to build your own confidence in your move back home by using the skills you already have. So welcome, Leonora.
Hi, Margot. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful to have you here. Where are we actually chatting with you?
I'm speaking with you from Melbourne, from my workplace in a very convenient booth.
Yeah, lovely. You look very professional today.
Thank you.
Now, before Hong Kong, there was a stint in Singapore, but I'm actually keen to go back to a time before your international story began. Can you take us back to what your life and career looked like before that time?
I was born and raised in Adelaide, and that's where I did my education and also my law degree. And I practiced law in Adelaide for probably, let's say 5-10 years. At the time that I had decided to move overseas, I was actually living in Sydney, where all up I'd spent about 5.5 years. I was, probably 15 years into my legal career, and feeling sort of professionally and personally a little itchy. I wanted to experience business sort of from in the way that my clients did, rather than having to try and understand it in the way that professional services providers often have to. I felt a little too much on the periphery. I wanted to be and see the business actually happen. And yeah, personally, I was also feeling really itchy. I knew there was some excitement and experience that was beyond Australia's fair shores, and I wanted to give that a go. However that was going to happen, and it just so happened that at that time, there was an opportunity to go to Singapore.
You essentially scratched the itch through a work opportunity that came to you initially.
It was actually a personal opportunity. I had a relationship and my partner had moved to Singapore ahead of me and said, why don't you come along? In terms of professionally, it actually worked out very well. I tried to resign from the law firm I was working for and they said, no, don't resign. Put the letter back in your pocket. Just go and open an office for us over there.
Oh, fabulous. Yeah.
That's what I did. And you know what? It was actually everything you could ask for, I think, on your first expat stint or your first overseas stint, because my job required me to go out and meet people. My job required me to pound the pavement. And I made some really excellent personal and professional connections, and professional connections that turned into great friendships very, very quickly.
So you had how long in Singapore?
6 years.
6 years. And then Hong Kong comes onto the radar.
Yes.
You went to Hong Kong with HSBC, is that correct? Or did you move up there and then find that role?
So at the time of leading Singapore, I was with Standard Chartered and I had secured the opportunity with HSBC. That's right. So I landed and started work with HSBC.
And you've often said to me that you loved your job and your time in Hong Kong with HSBC. What was it that you loved about it?
What I loved about HSBC in particular, some of this can be said for Standard Chartered as well. I loved working for a big organisation. There was just, you know, so many opportunities that I could pursue if I wanted to. I kind of saw it as a big sandbox. HSBC in particular, I love that it was a truly international organisation and just the level of complexity that that brought with it in everything we did, you know, sort of in terms of the big decisions that the power makers had to make that we all know about. And then even just the tasks and the projects I was working on, we always had to consider the added complexities that being an international organisation brought about. And then, you know, I just really worked with a lot of really high caliber and just good, fun people. It was most days a joy to go into work.
And life in Hong Kong, you obviously loved that. You know, you I think we said in the intro you had some family there, so you had a connection to the place.
My family had been living there sort of on and off since the 70s. And my dad was actually living in Hong Kong whilst I was living in Singapore. At the time that I moved, I didn't have any family. But, you know, there's something about your family knowing the place that you're living that was really, really helpful. And I also had a lot of great friends there. Whilst I was living in Singapore, I would travel to Hong Kong as often as I could. Standard Chartered afforded me a few trips as well, which was great. But what I loved about Hong Kong, I think you could probably, all the usual things that people love about Hong Kong, but one thing I particularly miss now is just how walkable a city it was. You know, I'd wake up on the weekends, I'd be out the door at 9, just doing all my errands, meeting friends, and, you know, I wouldn't get back home until 4, and then an hour or two later, I'd be back out the door on my feet heading to dinner. It was really lovely like that.
Yeah, so there's a sense of connectedness in that, isn't there? It's really quite lovely.
An absolute sense of connectedness and community because, you know, sure, I might have arranged a lunch with someone, but I would have bumped into 3 or 4 other people every day just on my travels.
When did your feelings about Hong Kong being your forever home start to change?
I think as an expat, you often think about when or if you're going to go home. So I don't think I had necessarily made the absolute final decision that it was going to be my forever home, particularly because I had family back home that were sort of often in my ear about when are you coming back. But look, I think I started considering a move back to Australia after about 18 months into the pandemic. And when I started feeling like I wasn't going to be able to visit Australia as frequently and as easily as I would have liked to. And as I was home in Australia 3 or 4 times a year. Or, you know, my mother would be in Hong Kong or Singapore with me. So it was, you know, I had that connection. And when that sort of started to get threatened, I didn't feel right.
Oh, no, it was a very tough time. I think that really brought that decision-making process forward for many. How long were you in Hong Kong in total?
In total, 4.5 years.
How long was it from deciding to coming home to actually jumping on the plane? Because I know you were very careful in your considerations or you gave it some deep thought.
And the plan actually took a little while to execute as well. So I would say probably a year from sort of the decision to getting on that flight on the 8th of June, I think it was.
And why Melbourne? Because, you know, you're an Adelaide-born girl. You know, Sydney was where you left from. Brisbane was also in the mix. How did Melbourne come to be the place?
Yeah, you're right. When you say Brisbane was in the mix, it was the first option I considered. And that's because my mother lives there as well as my brother with his young family. Look, to be honest, property prices were better in Brisbane than anywhere else. But I did spend a bit of time there on my way back and it just didn't feel quite like my kind of town. And later when I realised I was going to have a fiancé that I was bringing back home, I knew that it just wasn't the right place. Didn't know Melbourne very well at all. I had maybe had a couple of weekends here whilst I was still at home living in Adelaide. But I did certainly have the sense that it was more of a cultural fit with me than any other city in Australia. I was very keen to get into the design sort of world in Melbourne, which I'm still trying to do. I'll get there. And also I had some good friends here from, you know, friends who had left Adelaide and come directly to Melbourne. So I knew I had that.
Yeah, lovely. It's a bit of a softer landing when there's a couple of people you know, for sure. Did you ever have a sense that I hear people say this often, you know, when they go to somebody that's somewhere that's not their hometown, there's a sense that the adventure also continues that little bit. Did you have a sense of that at all?
Undoubtedly. And that was certainly part of my rationale. The adventure was going to continue.
And so what kind of career preparations did you take while you were still in Hong Kong? And I guess how long did you, or were you going to allow yourself to find a role? You know, did you have that in the back of your mind when you were leaving, like you'd were planning that out?
Absolutely. But starting with your first questions, what kind of career preparations? Well, I listened to the Boomeranging podcast every morning as I was doing my skipping.
Hopefully it was encouraging and not terrifying.
It was encouraging. No, it actually really was. It was a great help. And I joined the InSync webinars. You know, we laugh, but that actually was really, really helpful and possibly almost vital in helping me at least psychologically make the transition and understand what I was going to be facing. I also started reconnecting with my Australian network. And I worked on a potential risk advisory business as a backup. So I sort of had two plans going at once, getting a job or running this business. In terms of timing, in my mind, before I got anywhere near to landing in Melbourne, I was, you know, I had in my head to just kick around for a good 3 or 4 months. I remember speaking to my brother and saying, yeah, I'm going to take this time off. I'm going to go to galleries, I might get a job in a bookshop and, you know, and then I'll think about starting a role.
And reality?
Well, the reality was there certainly wasn't any kicking around and sitting in cafes, that's for sure. That went out the window as soon as I landed. I was like a deer in headlights. If I'm really honest with myself, I felt a little out of control because everything had just been turned upside down and I kind of craved the comfort and the familiarity of a job and a job schedule and having that routine. And so I got straight onto that as soon as I landed. You know, I even hired a co-working space so that I actually had somewhere to go in the mornings. So I wasn't, you know, to be honest, I wasn't there 5 days a week, but I was probably there 2 or 3 days a week. The first thing I did there, because you know, I turn up and it's like, okay, I'm here. I've got a coffee. What now? I just redrafted my CV, carried on networking via LinkedIn and applying for jobs.
I do really love that piece around you almost created your own sense of office, you know, by having this co-working space. I think that's a really lovely tip for those that really like that structure and connectivity. We often talk about transition, you know, career transition. Yes, there's a financial transition and a job transition, but there's also a really big emotional transition. And you can get lost in that, you know, putting some sort of structure in to support that transition is just so, so important. So I love your tip around that.
Yeah, it wasn't perfect every day. And I recall one afternoon I had a nap. I woke up a good 2 hours later. And I felt refreshed, but I felt so guilty and confused. I just didn't know what I was meant to be doing with myself. So
yeah,
whilst I needed it, I didn't have it in me to relax at that point.
Yeah, I think sometimes too, we often relax once we know we've got the job, even if there's another 4 weeks till starting time. That's the time when you really relax because you know you've got something in the bag, so to speak.
That's right.
You've said to me initially that you and your partner originally chose the wrong place to live. What do you mean by that? Or what was the mistake, do you think, that you made?
I think the approach was right. So basically, we front run as much of the logistical stuff as we could, including finding a home. So we found property agents and my fiancé and I actually signed the lease, furnished the house and even bought groceries before we landed. He arrived at the house at like 9 p.m. on a Monday night and there were groceries that had just been dropped off at the front door. And he actually was startled by a delivery driver who brought his dinner for him as well. So we were
You were planned.
So we were planned. So I actually think that approach was right because I did not have the headspace and I knew he wouldn't have had the headspace and I knew together it would not have been a good idea if we were spending time visiting rental properties and living in a serviced apartment. To be fair, Melbourne doesn't have that many serviced apartments either. So it was just, I just want to walk into the house we're going to live in. So I think that approach was right. The other point is, you know, we just didn't really know what we were looking at. So there's always going to be the risk that you're going to find something that you don't love. And then the fact is, I think I didn't understand how much we'd have to pay for rental properties here. And I was trying to, you know, not knowing when I was going to get a job, knowing that I'd like to buy a house or we'd like to buy a house as soon as possible. I wanted us to budget a bit on the rent and I don't think that that played out well for us.
Were you in the wrong area or it was just the wrong style of house or wrong sort of community for you?
I think the area was okay. It was the wrong style of house. It was dark and cold and cavernous and, you know, it didn't feel like a safe landing place at all. And it compounded the difficult parts of the transition. I put it this way, our rescue dog even felt the same way. He didn't even like that house. And he had just come from a dog shelter.
So you made the move, obviously. You found the area that you love and a place that you are now. You've landed.
That's right. That's right. We've since moved and sort of this has been a bit of a lesson that I've learned because we're paying quite a bit more rent now than what we were then. But it's been worth every penny. It doesn't always work out the best in terms of how much you like a place or like a thing or even, you know, on the bank balance by economising. You know, sometimes you do just have to bite the bullet and spend a bit more money on some things.
Now, you spoke a little bit earlier about engaging your networks before you left, but also once you hit the ground here. Can you talk us about what your approach to that was and how you actually engaged with them?
Yeah. There's no magic to it. I wish I could tell you I did something really clever, but I didn't. I just reviewed my entire LinkedIn network and I made a list of contacts, both those that I was very familiar with and a lot that I wasn't so familiar with. And I just reached out to them by LinkedIn Messenger. Interestingly, what I found was that I actually had the most success with the contacts I knew less well and the contacts of contacts. You know, people who weren't even in my LinkedIn network, but I was referred to as potentially relevant people to speak to were fantastic. There was one occasion where I was at the breakfast bar, still in my pajamas, but on LinkedIn and making a comment on a non-work related post. And someone else got in contact with me in response to that comment. And 5 minutes later, we were actually on the phone having a chat, introducing ourselves. And he introduced me to a good deal of people who were all lovely and useful and some very useful in terms of securing a role. So yeah, it was LinkedIn all the way and no magic.
I think it's really about showing up, isn't it? You know, it's about showing up and engaging. And I think when we've been in really big roles, we've been so busy delivering our roles, not so much focused on the networks. And yet that's what we need to sort of secure our next role. So I think showing up and just investing that time is so important. Why do you think you were successful in securing your current role 6 months after returning home? Because that's not a it's not a long, long time when you think about moving life and career.
Yeah. Look, I think like with all things, there's some serendipity involved or a lot of serendipity involved. But as you say, I sort of worked hard to stay on top of opportunities and let people know that I was in Melbourne, that I was available and that I was really keen to get myself in the Australian risk and governance market. So yeah, I really just showed up and was persistent and I was happy to talk to anyone. And on that actually, I do have to say, people in Melbourne were extremely generous with their time and their advice. So, you know, some of the people I engaged with, even those that I sort of cold called in inverted commas, were very senior and always extremely busy, but they really literally gave me their time, be it coffee or FaceTime. And that really helped. It helped even when it didn't help with an actual opportunity, it helped keep me buoyed and keep me pursuing, and it gave me another millimetre to pursue.
I think it's really important sometimes to think about the purpose of our networks, and because it's not always about getting a job. It might be about educating you on a particular industry or educating you on a particular city and the way things are operating. So just building our, I guess, intelligence bank of the ways of doing business is all just so helpful in our dialogue. And we then build, don't we? We build on layers of conversations.
I think the other thing to add there, I was also pursuing consultancy work and a partnership with an ex-boss of mine, in fact, from Standard Chartered. So I had that on the back burner, and I was myself starting to get worried at about that sort of 4, 5, 6 month mark. So I sort of pressed the pedal on that. And we were actually successful in securing a piece of work. So I think that in addition to everything we just described, the luck and the generosity of contacts, I would have probably started moving things along with the consultancy at that point in any event, just because it was there and I was getting worried, rightly or wrongly, but I was getting worried at that point.
I certainly meet a lot of former expats who are running a parallel process in that path. So I think that that's not always unusual. I think there's that just that appetite to sort of create and to do something and to get things moving. So it's a sense of, you know, as you said earlier, taking that control back and understanding that we need to invest and explore. So
yes.
Did you think it would take more or less time? Like, did you have a view? Because I think sometimes that's the hardest thing to reconcile. If you think, okay, I'll be back, I'll take 3 months to, you know, sort out the logistics and unpack the boxes and then I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
But if that doesn't happen when you're ready, if the market's not buying when you're not ready, that can be a bit of a disconnect too.
Yeah, I think I probably thought it would take less time. I just described how I was starting to get worried towards the end of 2022, just because I like to worry when I don't have things in order. But also, I was actually starting to see and hear more of what I had been warned about before I left Asia. And that was the disregard some Australian companies have towards international experience. And so the more I felt like this might actually be a realistic blocker, the more I was getting concerned about the amount of time that I was spending out of the market.
It's definitely, I think, something that you've kind of almost got to sense check or self check where you're at as well, so that you can pivot on the plan if you like. So what does life look like in Melbourne today?
It's calm, it's productive, it's happy, it's full of coffees, it's full of croissants, and that's two every weekend, unashamedly, and lots of dog walks, yeah.
And now you've secured your role, but you've also got a board role as well, haven't you? That was something else that came out of the path.
I do. Look, I've got to say, things really sort of started heating up by the end of 2022. And I saw an opportunity to get an opportunity for a board role and company secretary role with the Nappy Collective, which is a not-for-profit, which, as the name suggests, it focuses on securing nappies for families in need. And I just wanted to get out there and do some volunteer work. I sort of do believe in people needing the fundamentals and that sort of really making a difference in their lives. And I wanted the board experience, I'll put that plainly.
Were you actively chasing a board role, or did that sort of emerge out of your network conversations and the communities that you found yourself having these conversations in?
It came up on LinkedIn again, but it was certainly in the back of my mind, and it was something that I was going to pursue at some point. And I think this opportunity just came up. And because the Nappy Collective was at a point where it was getting big enough to really require some good risk governance around it, that excited me. I didn't just want a board position. I wanted to go in and actually help an organisation put a risk management framework around it. It's really rewarding, actually. The first few months I was trying to find my feet and I didn't know how much value I was going to add, but it's warming up and I'm doing a fair bit there, and it's really rewarding.
Well, it's a lovely marriage of skills and, you know, passion and direction, right? Purpose. So, yeah.
Exactly.
How was the transition for your partner?
Look, luckily, Melbourne, as the place we've decided to call home, hasn't been a decision that we've questioned, or I don't think he's questioned it. He seems very happy here. But he's also really lucky in that he can perform his job from home. So he's sort of quite happy working at home with the dog and feeling quite settled in that regard. So that's been very helpful for him. But, you know, having said that, whilst he didn't have the stress of looking for work, settling into life here has had its challenges. Landing at the beginning of a brutal Melbourne winter was not ideal. And, you know, he was also an expat. He was pre-COVID. He was a really, really heavy traveller. COVID took it out of all of us. And so he was just exhausted when he got here as well. You know, and managing the ups and downs of me finding my feet was something, you know, he had to get involved with as well. And that's often not easy for a dedicated partner, which he is.
Yeah. And for him, you know, Melbourne, it's not just a new city, it's a new country because he's a Brit, isn't he? So he hadn't really been here a lot, you know, he was exploring it through your lens.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the fact that Melbourne was quite new to me was also very helpful in that dynamic as well, because I didn't want him to move to my hometown. I wanted us both to move somewhere new so that we would be discovering it together. So he wouldn't feel like the odd one out if he was confused about how to get somewhere, because I also didn't know how to get anywhere.
No. Use the trams, whatever it might be. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Have you done a hook turn yet? No, yeah. I did my first one today.
Hook turns, that's another thing, right? If you're coming to Melbourne, you've got to navigate.
I've met people who have been here for 14 years and they will ask the question, have you done a hook turn yet? I said, I've done it once. And they will admit to only having done it, you've done a hook turn maybe twice, yeah.
Or just completely avoiding those streets that you have to go and that involve a hook turn.
Great drive in the CBD, yeah.
You're now a year into landing. What advice would you give other expat repats managing their transition home?
I basically couch my advice to other expats and repats in the same terms as I couch my risk advice to businesses. And that's, think of your return to Australia like a game of squash. Make sure you've got the walls in place, make sure you've got the lines in place, put your safety goggles on, and then just sort of hit the ball as hard as you like, hit it wherever you like. But
I like
that. Yeah. Yeah. And then chill out, like just land, relax, sit in cafes, go to a gallery, meditate, chill out, and then get to it. Then build your squash court.
Yeah. So are you doing all those things now? Are you chilling out? Are you doing all those? Because you said earlier you couldn't really do it at first.
Look, I will prefix my response with I'm also organising a wedding at the moment. But yeah. Look, I think that I'm not necessarily relaxing, but life is calmer. Life is absolutely calmer. Life is comfortable. Life has a nice routine to it. Yeah, we have a happy, calm home, and work is the same, and it's all very productive, which is how I like it.
Now, as you know, we like to close all of our chats with five quick questions. So I'm going to put those to you now. Living overseas taught me what about myself?
That I can be completely independent. Living overseas has taught me that from the most major life experiences to the most mundane, I can do it. And sure, you know, with the support of friends and family at the end of the phone, but I can live alone if I need to. And it's something that gives me a lot of pride.
The number one skill I use today in my career is?
Yeah, look, I'm not sure if this is a skill more than perhaps just an approach, but it's really just trying to do the right thing, you know, whether it's on a work task or on a people task. And I'm not saying I always nail it, but the very sort of act of just trying to do the right thing and having people see and understand that seems to be something that translates and is appreciated across cultures and languages. Actually, I think also, and this is a skill, how to craft emails that busy people are actually going to absorb.
Yes.
Glenn Foltink, who was one of your earlier guests and one of my bosses overseas, actually taught me how to write emails in a corporate workplace, which was very different to how you would write an email as a lawyer in private practice. And it was a game changer, frankly.
Great. We definitely need that when you think about how many things hit our inbox every day. The best thing I've discovered since arriving home is
dogs. Ah. Melbourne is such a dog town, and I wasn't a dog person, but I absolutely am now.
Oh, yes. And the dog parks. How amazing are those communities?
They're brilliant. They're absolutely brilliant.
Mm. The first thing I'd encourage a new repat to do is?
Sleep, meditate, exercise, look at some art, and then get to it.
Beautiful. A word, song, or quote that best describes my time overseas is?
Margot, I have been wondering about my answer to this since I first started listening to Boomeranging podcasts. So for a very long time. And I would like to give you a very sophisticated response, but I can't.
Right. So, that's okay.
But let me explain my choice first. And that is, I really found when I was in Asia that I became extremely patriotic. I became very emotional around Anzac Day, Australia Day. And when I started feeling quite isolated and concerned about my ability to come home during that COVID period, it really reached its height. And I found myself listening to a lot of Cold Chisel. So the best song that describes my time overseas is Working Class Man by Cold Chisel.
I love it.
It gives me goosebumps even now.
Yeah. Well, I've gone goosey just hearing it now that you've given me the lead up too. So that's fantastic. Look, Leonora, I've so enjoyed our conversation.
Me too.
Thank you so much. Yes, I'll hopefully see you out and about in Melbourne town.
It's going to be wonderful. Thank you, Margot. This has been great.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review, share it with your friends and family, and subscribe for future episodes. For more information on our guests, please head to our website, insyncnetworkgroup.com, where you can check out the show notes and also find more information about our career advisory programs and fabulous community.